You are listening to a sermon by Evan Kreider, recorded on Sunday, August 6, 2017, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Today's lectionary includes Psalm 17, and I invite you to turn to it in your bulletins. It's an unusually intense prayer, which pleads for protection from an unidentified enemy. Although Psalm 17 has traditionally been attributed to David, and it even says a Davidic plea, modern scholars agree that David could never have written it. It uses word structure and language which is more from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, centuries later. That doesn't matter. As with all literature, the success of Psalm 17 depends on how subsequent generations understand it. Is there anything in the wording or in the ideas that speaks to our generation? In spite of the language being changed, and in spite of the passing of many cultures. As we have just noticed when reading the psalm aloud, it divides nicely into five sections. The first section includes verses 1 and 2. In these verses, Yahweh is begged to pay attention to the prayer that is being made by someone, unnamed, who is facing severe and seemingly unsolvable problems. Now, throughout this psalm, we're going to hear the poet cite ways in which he thinks he has tried to live a godly life. And the first example of this self-examination appears in the very first sentence with the words, "lips free of deceit." On another topic, we are told that in biblical times, some individuals, being hounded by powerful landowners and their teams of lawyers, would remain in the temple to pray and seek divine assistance day and night. They did not know where else to turn. I can imagine that their prayers were indeed fervent. In that context, notice the action words in the first two verses. Hear, attend, give ear. There is real urgency in this prayer. In the second section of Psalm 17, verses 3 to 5, the petitioner describes in more detail his life of faithfulness to Yahweh. Verse 3 suggests that although we might be able to hide our evil thoughts from others during the day, in Old Testament times, it was assumed that at night we lost control of our thoughts in our dreams, and then God can surely discover our innermost thoughts, be they good or otherwise. The end of verse 3, "My mouth does not transgress," could also be paraphrased, "I do not break out in heated words," implying that the poet feels that he has been able to keep his cool even when lies are said about him by his enemies. The self-examination in this section reminds me of the words of Psalm 1. It seems that our petitioner feels that he has not walked in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stood in the way of sinners, nor seated himself in the seat of those who are scornful of the righteous. I think we should assume that the petitioner is not being self-righteous. Rather, I assume that the poet really has tried to live honestly and uprightly, just as we are trying to do. In the third section, verses 6 to 9, The petitioner once again asks Yahweh to pay attention and give protection. Notice the imperatives, the verbs that call for action on God's part. Incline your ear to me. Hear my words. Show your steadfast love. Guard me. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. Wings in the Old Testament became a metaphor for God's protection. The wings of the cherubim above the Ark of the Covenant were an artistic visual symbol representing God's continual protection. The fourth section, verses 10 to 12, focuses dramatically on my wicked enemies. The phrase, "they close their hearts to pity," implies that no reasonable discussion is possible. In verses 11 and 12, the poet switches to the metaphor of hungry lions, eager to pounce, but for now they are quietly prowling, watching the moment to strike. The victim does not know when his enemies will bring financial destruction upon him and his family. Fear not, the lions usually win. Unless, of course, they're the BC lions. In the fifth section, verses 13 to the end, we have the final plea for Yahweh, God, to act. Notice the wording in verse 13. Rise up, confront, overthrow them, by your sword, deliver me. And then verse 14b is unbelievably violent. May their bellies be filled with what you have stored up for them. May their children have more than enough. May they leave something over to their little ones. In other words, these unnamed enemies, who seem to be unstoppable, grabbing land or inheritances or whatever, punish them and their children and their grandchildren. After all, if they steal land and inheritances, their children and grandchildren will be the beneficiaries. So instead of fattening them with stolen wealth, punish them. Jesus will then change that. Verse 15 suddenly returns to a state of calm, to trusting completely in God. The petitioner is essentially saying, okay, I've made my case before you. If my enemies are to be filled with my wealth, well, let me be filled with your presence, with your peace. Let me see your face. Now, some reflections. For reasons I readily understand, the traditional lectionary reading omits the difficult verses about our enemies. When I read the psalm, I gulped. I found those verses absolutely puzzling. So I decided, let's study it. I now think that the entire point of verses 1 to 7 is to set up the heart of the prayer. Those verses desperately begging for protection from enemies. The verses asking that the petitioner be treated fairly by God, not judged unfairly by wealthy, powerful, corrupt men. This psalm is particularly intriguing. It is essentially saying, yes, God may have heard our earlier prayers of praise and thanksgiving, which is all well and good. But now we have a serious matter. We are in deep trouble, and we really need to be certain that this prayer is being heard and that there will be immediate help. So as I considered this psalm, I asked myself, Who are my enemies? You can raise your hand if you wish. If I were a Christian living in a territory controlled by religious fanatics from another faith, I would surely identify those oppressors as my enemies. Psalm 17 must speak very powerfully to such Christians as they dread possible persecution by those who are prowling around, surrounding them, deciding secretly when to strike, when to burn down their church, rather than discussing or offering options. But I live in Vancouver. In our block, we live peacefully beside Jews, Catholics, Muslims, Buddhists, atheists, an ex-Mennonite, and people with no interest in spirituality whatsoever. We all get along. We know our children's names, their children's names. We share meals during block parties. No problem. So, thankfully, this morning, I cannot name a single person that is making so much trouble for me that I would actually consider that person to be my enemy. But that has not always been the case in my life. One conceited and particularly headstrong colleague at UBC did indeed become an enemy to me and just about everyone else in the department, and even tried to fire me and Greg. As luck would have it, our enemy died of a heart attack before he could take matters too far. There is a God.
It's a creative music.
He was the UBC's last head for life. When you were appointed head at UBC of a department, you were head until you retired. After him, UBC changed the rule. So during those troubled days in the mid-1970s, the many psalms talking about enemies spoke very directly to me. I prayed them like I had not prayed a psalm ever before. But I can think of other so-called enemies. Enemies that are not people. For instance, if I had persistent pain, if I had an ongoing medical problem that wore me down and never, ever improved, if I had incurable cancer, if I had worries that debilitated me, or if I simply could not find work and did not know where money would come from, or if I suffered endless sleepless nights, without hesitation, I would identify those situations as being my enemies. And I would think of them when reading this psalm. Another challenge in Psalm 17 is the way the poet or psalmist approaches God. It's not the way I approach God. I never, in my prayer, remind God of how good I've been today. I assume everything I did, everything I think, is already known. I never demand or beg that God listen to me. I just assume God hears. I never hurl action verbs at God, demanding that God answer me, save me. I assume that's up to God. I never lay out my case to God. Again, I assume God knows better than I do. But Charles Spurgeon made an interesting suggestion in the context of this psalm. He says that we should not just make requests to God. Instead, Spurgeon argues that we need to make a case to God when praying, just as the poet did in Psalm 17. Not because God needs to be convinced, not because God can be persuaded, but because if we make our case with sufficient care and honesty, realizing that we are praying to God and that we are aware of God and God is aware of us, that exercise might just help us to understand our situation a bit more clearly. We may become a little more honest with ourselves. In other words, making the case would be really for our benefit, not God's. We might just learn that our case is pretty weak, or that our situation is somewhat unimportant in the context of the universe or eternity. Another challenge in Psalm 17 is that the prayer is asking only on behalf of the person making the prayer. One writer helpfully suggested that before praying Psalm 17 on our own behalf, we should try praying it on behalf of someone else. Pray Psalm 17 for someone in this church, and then pray it for yourself. In verse 15, I like to think that the petitioner is finally coming to peace, an inner peace, possibly after an entire night devoted to prayer in the temple. He has made his case as clearly as he can in God's presence, and now he possibly understands it better in the context of life itself. Whatever happens tomorrow, the psalmist knows that he has been living a just and godly life, and therefore he feels that these enemies are not surrounding him because God wishes to punish him. When he awakes the next morning, he will try to be content with being filled with God's presence, as one of the translations says, or with seeing God's face. This verse reminds me of when I lay on the operating table before undergoing surgery for colon cancer. I knew I would soon be going under, that grown men and women with very sharp knives and very strong hands would be cutting very deeply into my very considerable gut. Nobody knew if the cancer had spread or not, and indeed, if the cancer had spread, we all knew that the operation would be useless. But strangely, I was at peace. I don't know why. I just felt I had God's peace, and that cancer, my new enemy, was no longer just my problem. The whole situation was essentially out of my hands. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. I thought to myself, if this is it, I'm ready to go. I've tried to live a good life. However, I really doubt that I would have similar peaceful thoughts if I were racked with constant pain, like my cousin or my mom. I really don't know, because I've not faced such a trial. I also have to wonder if I would be able to find this kind of inner peace if I were cornered in a war zone in Syria for months on end, not knowing when it would end, not knowing when the next ISIS soldier or the next drone would be visiting our neighborhood with bombs. I don't know. And so, I intend to spend more time with Psalm 17, so that I can learn to pray it and other psalms like it in different ways, on behalf of other people, facing their own personal enemies, and not just on behalf of myself. And I will pray Psalm 17 in the hope that I and those I pray for can find peace, no matter who or what the enemy or outcome might be.